Amen. You guys can take a seat. Well, my name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors here. I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? All right. We're in the second Sunday of a brand new decade, and we're in the second Sunday of a series called How to Start a Decade. And I'll be real with you guys. We thought about calling this series 2020 Vision, because like 2020, right? I even self-designed an amazing graphic for it, because I felt like you get one shot in your life as a pastor to have that kind of perfect alignment on a cheesy series title. But then thought a little bit about it, realized just because you can do something doesn't always mean you should. So you're all welcome for that. But we're also talking about how to start a decade rather than just how to start a year, because I think sometimes we need to look further ahead. It's easy to drastically overestimate what we can accomplish in the short term and drastically underestimate what God can accomplish in us, through us, and for us in the long term. So we're kicking off this decade by taking a look at the condition of our hearts, looking in the mirror at who we are and who we are becoming, and trying to take some steps in the direction of the life God says He has for us. And I'm trying to help us do that by sharing with all of you the four questions I've learned to ask myself that I really, really wish I would have started asking sooner. And they aren't the only four questions you can ask yourself, and they aren't some sort of secret to perfection as a human being. Those of you who know me know that they are not accomplishing that in my life. But they do serve as kind of a life dashboard, as warning lights and gauges that help me know where I'm going and why I'm going that way. And last week, we kicked off the series by talking about my first dashboard question: what is my posture? Am I approaching people and tasks with a posture of pride or a posture of humility? And this morning I want to dig into the second question, and it's this: who are my people? Who are my people? And I realize that seems like an incredibly simplistic question to ask, but I've grown more and more convinced that it's important, that it's one we need to rethink and remind ourselves of regularly, because if we're going to take this journey God has for us, if we're going to live the stories He wants to write in our lives, then we have to find our people. One of the best ways to know where you're going is to take a look at who you're going with. Sometimes I think we treat the future like it's this ethereal force that's just like intangible and it's out there, and we get really superstitious about it or really fatalistic about it. Like, oh, it's just fate. There's nothing I can do about it. And it's true that we have way less control over the future than we'd like, but you can aim your future in a certain direction. You can look ahead and see where you're going, and your two greatest clues, if you want to do that, are the choices you make and the people you choose, whether you want to believe that or not. In college, I played intramural softball with a bunch of my buddies, and one year we made the championship game. And we were up one going into the bottom half of the last inning. We were like three outs away from some amazing t-shirts that said Drake Intramural Champions and like legendary status forever and all that stuff. And so it was pretty exciting. And I ran out to take my position at second base. And one of my best friends, Scott, took his position at shortstop. And we got two quick outs. And after that, the other team got some people on base. And then it happened. A guy ripped a line drive right up the middle, and I got a beat on it. And so I yelled, I got it, and I dove for the ball. And right as I was diving, I heard Scott yell, I got it. And he's the shortstop, so it's his ball. And I pulled my glove back just a fraction of a second later than I needed to, because the ball glanced off the very end of my glove into Scott's face. And as he crumpled to the ground with a broken nose, just bleeding a lot, like all over the place, they scored two runs and we lost. But we did get a fun trip to the ER out of it, and Scott looked pretty cool with his nose brace for a couple weeks. The ladies loved it, so I gifted him that. And years later, I'd like to make one thing clear. I still blame him. It was his fault for being dumb. I was midair when he called me off. And he lives in St. Louis now, and just don't be surprised if he watches this on Facebook and comments something about how it was actually my fault and I'm a bad friend, but he's, whatever. Anyways, this is what I wonder. I wonder how many of us are doing life kind of like Scott and I played softball. Like, we're surrounded by other people. Theoretically, we're pulling in the same direction as those other people. We're on a team with those people, but when push comes to shove, we're saying, I got it. I don't need anybody's help. I don't want anybody's help. I don't care how difficult things get. I don't care what comes at me. I don't care how hard that ball was hit. In the end, I got it. I can do this alone. I don't mind being around other people. I don't mind hanging out with other people. I don't mind the idea that I'm like on a team with other people. I just really don't want to need other people. I don't want to be vulnerable. I want to be able to say that I am self-reliant and self-sufficient because that's what society says I should be. And my suspicion is that most of us live like that a whole lot more than we want to admit. We just try and do it alone because we think that we should. It's like, all right, so I'm living my life. We get that box from IKEA. We open it up and think, how hard could this be? I'll just handle it. I'll handle it by myself. And we look at a cartoon next to like four things, and 5 hours in a roll of duct tape later, we're like, I don't think it probably needed those three screws or that board. Like it's supposed to lean. That's how Europeans do it. So like, I got it is the American life motto. And that would be amazing if it worked, but it usually doesn't. I got it results in too many broken noses and crooked tables for us to keep believing it's a pathway forward. We're built to work together, and something inside of us knows that, even though our culture tells us the opposite thing. Even though we keep trying to convince ourselves that we're self-sufficient and self-reliant, we tend to move alongside groups, like in tribes. The truth of life is that no matter how much you think you're going it alone, and no matter how hard you try, you're going to end up in a boat with somebody, rowing in a certain direction. If you don't pause every once in a while and look around and ask, who am I in the boat with, you might end up in the wrong place. Like if the people you're getting in the boat with and hitching your wagon to and doing life alongside are rowing in a direction that you do not want to go, then you got to change boats. And listen, I'm not saying that we don't need to give our lives and our love to people we know are rowing in the wrong direction. That we shouldn't leverage ourselves and our resources for the sake of the needy and the broken. We have to do that. That's what following Jesus looks like. But you guys, we cannot do that well. We cannot follow in the footsteps of Jesus without getting in the boat alongside a community that is rowing in the direction of God, that is encouraging us, that's building us up along the way. That's how we're made to do it. One of the core values of Revision Church, one of the things that drives everything we do, is this idea that God loves us. In Jesus, we are loved, and loved people do life with people. We really believe that. Loved people do life with people because people are a source of life for us, and it matters that we get plugged into the right source. A couple days ago, my kids were watching a movie, and I was in my room reading, and then our 8-year-old Emma ran in and said, Daddy, Daddy, the screen turned all purple. And my first thought was, oh no, because I am a technological idiot. Like if they changed a setting or broke something, I'm about the last human on earth that could fix it. So I went down and I was really excited because it was, they just turned the input to TV instead of DVD player. And I was like, Daddy can fix it, don't worry. I was like really proud of myself. And I hit the button and everything was going good for 3 minutes. And then she ran in again, it happened again. So I went down and I explained it to her this time. I said, see, the movie is coming from the DVD player. So if you hit a button that changes it to TV, it's not going to play what you want because it's not connected to the right source. You see this button on our remote that says source? Just keep hitting the button that says source until it says DVD player and your movie will play. And it clicked for an 8-year-old. And I'm praying it clicks for all of us today. Because for me, that's what that dashboard question, who are my people, is all about. It's about asking myself, am I plugged in to the source that God has for me? Am I plugged in to a people that are building me up and encouraging me and breathing life into me? Encouraging me to chase Jesus. Because I know that's the way I'm meant to do it. That's on every page of the Bible. I think it's impossible to open up that book and come to any other conclusion. It's impossible to open up that book and think that we can do life and faith alone. Because literally the whole story, like the story of Israel in the Old Testament, the story of the church in the New Testament, is the story of God always creating a people, like his people, to connect with one another and connect with him and be a light for the broken world that's living in darkness. You just cannot open your Bible without coming to the conclusion that the journey to God always brings us to his people, to one another, every time. And there may be faith journeys that begin alone, all on your own, but they never fail to lead to a place of community, of knowing and being known. The Bible's just full of stories like that. And I realize it's easy to read it sometimes and think that it's just about these great, crazy, courageous, kind of standalone individuals like Moses and David and Peter and Paul. And sometimes we read all of history like that. We think American history is just like George Washington and Abe Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Martin Luther King Jr. And we tend to believe that the story of humanity is just written by their individual greatness, while forgetting that every single one of those people had whole organizations and armies behind them. People who fought for them, people who encouraged them, people who taught them, people who gave their lives to those men and for those men and women so that they could do the things that they did. There's not one human being on the planet who ever accomplished anything worthwhile, anything lasting, and anything meaningful on their own. Nobody, ever. And there's nobody in the Bible who did either. Like in Exodus 18, we read the story of Moses, and his father-in-law Jethro came to visit him and took a look at what he was doing, and he's like, dude, you cannot handle this. You're trying to lead a whole nation on your own? You're not good enough, man. You're not smart enough. You're not capable enough. And a lot of us have been told that by our father-in-laws, but Moses' father-in-law was right. And Moses took it to God, and God was like, yeah, man, I've been waiting for you to figure that out. Pick some leaders. Get them alongside you so they can share the load. And Moses found his people, his leaders, his team to come alongside him, and they saved his life, and they saved his leadership. 1 Chronicles 12, we read the story of David. He's been anointed to be the next king of Israel, but at this point, he's not king yet, and he's on the run for his life from the current king, King Saul. He's kind of hiding out in the wilderness, not knowing what the future holds. And we read that this whole group of men and their families went and joined him in the wilderness to fight for him as his army. And there was a small group of about 30 of them that became his best friends and his greatest generals. They were known as the Gibberim, the brave ones, the mighty men of David. The truth is, David had an awesome story, but he never would have become king if he didn't find his people. And Paul, we see Paul as this great, courageous missionary who braved the elements and braved prison and braved all the threats against his life to bring the gospel to the world, and he totally did, but not alone. He constantly reminds us in his letters of the people he could not have done it without. Aquila and Priscilla, Timothy and Philemon, and more. And even the New Testament, almost half of the new books in the New Testament are written by Paul. But almost none of what's written is written by Paul. He was too blind to write clearly on his own. And so what we have in the New Testament is a whole bunch of letters that were dictated by Paul. And most of them were written down by his ministry co-worker Tertius. Except for like the very end of the book of Galatians, where in the original manuscript, the letters get sloppy and giant as Paul writes, see that how big the letters are that I'm writing this with my own hand? It's hilarious. It's Galatians 6:11. You can read it. The Bible's good stuff. But I look at that and I wonder, like, if Paul didn't find his people, what are the implications? What are the implications for the spread of the gospel to the world, to the entire European continent? What are the implications for the Bible? But he did. He found them because he knew that is how God made him to do it. And he talks about that. He gives us kind of a powerful illustration of what that looks like in the book of Romans, chapter 12. So if you got a Bible or a Bible with you today, you can crack it open to Romans, chapter 12. It's right between Acts and 1 Corinthians. If you don't have one, no worries. You can follow along on the screen or in the Revision app. And if you need a Bible, we have them for kids and teens and adults back at the Next Steps table. We love it when they disappear. They're free. Please take what you need before you go. But Romans 12, starting in verse 4, Paul's talking about us, about the church, about what this whole movement of Jesus is supposed to look like and be like in the world. And this is what he writes. For just as each one of us has one body with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, so in Christ we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. I love this word picture Paul uses here. He says the church, the community of people gathered to chase Jesus together, is like a body. I think there's some important implications in what he says there that we gotta understand if we're gonna start this decade right and aim our lives in the direction God has for us to go. And the first one is this: we need other people because we are incomplete without them. I know that's offensive. I get it. That's like super countercultural to tell a bunch of Americans that they cannot do it on their own and they're not complete without people around them. But that's what Paul's telling us. He's looking at all of us and saying, hey, look, without other people, this is you, okay? You're just a leg. You can't go through life as just a leg. That's weird. It doesn't work. I know you want to think, I got it, but, right? But we are Americans. We're like, no. Paul, I can live fully alive without, I'm doing fine. I got it. Don't worry. I got it. See? Look, I got it. And Paul, if Paul were standing here today, he'd be like, no, you don't got it. Now you're just a leg with a face and arms drawn on it. And to be honest, the severed leg was creepy enough. You're just being weird. You got to stop it. This isn't how God made you to do it. You got to just forget it, okay? Don't do that. So he's trying to tell all of us, like, we need other people to be for us what we cannot be for ourselves. We need other people to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And I, like, can I have a vulnerable moment with you guys? I knew that was true before we started Revision Church, but I know it on a way deeper level now. Like, 4 years ago, like, that dashboard question, who are my people, meant something to me, but it's taken on a whole lot of significance over the last 4 years. Because honestly, when people started talking to me about planting a church, I really didn't want to do it. I held my hand up to the idea for as long as I possibly could, and one of the biggest reasons why is that I had read a lot about starting new churches. I talked to church planters, to lead pastors, to a whole bunch of senior level leaders, and there was this theme that kept coming up and what they said to me. This common challenge that so many of them talked about and so many books wrote about. They said, it's lonely. And it is so lonely. I had person after person after person look me in the eyes and say, look, this is a difficult, spiritually heavy, profoundly isolating thing to do. And you're going to have moments where you feel like you're abandoned and lost and nobody cares and nobody knows and you're carrying the weight completely alone. And you're going to be surrounded by people, but you will feel more lonely than you have ever felt in your entire life. You'll feel more lonely than you ever knew was possible. And I don't know if that sounds like a good time to any of you, but it really didn't sound like a good time to me. And so I didn't want to plant a church. And I remember praying while I still didn't want to plant a church, but I was thinking maybe God was going to make me. I prayed this for years. I said, God, if you make me do this, please don't send me alone. God, I don't want to do it, but if I have to, like, if this is the path, if this is the way forward, if this is the, like, the story you want to write for me, I will do it. I will obey no matter what. But if I have to do that, please, God, don't make me do it alone. Because I was aware of what I am and what I am not. That I'm a leg, and drawing a face and arms on myself was not going to make me more than that. Like, I just couldn't do it, and I needed people, and I needed encouragement along the way. And one of the greatest answers to prayer of my entire life is that God said yes to that request. Like, originally, he sent 12 other people, including my family. And then over a couple months, that 12 became this little crew of 40 who joined a launch team. Said, let's get this thing going. And in those first weeks and months, 40 became about 75. In the last 4 years, 75 has become over 400. And you have been everything that I prayed for and more. Like, it's so much cooler than I thought it would be. Like, Revision is so much better than me. It's so much more than just, like, the my gifts. And that's because all of you put your gifts on the table and we're all winning because of it. Like, I'm winning because of it. I love you guys. I love you. Thank you so much for being my people, for being who you are. Like, seriously, I can stand here and tell you with a straight face, this has not been the lonely journey that so many leaders looked me in the eye and described. It's been the complete opposite. It's been connection and community. It's been like what I think the church is supposed to be. What I think the church was always supposed to be. I mean, we get caught up confusing, like, church with a place we go to. It's like, I'm going to church, and in our minds, church is a space or a building, and it's not our fault that we think that. The word church comes from this Germanic word, Kirche, which means house of God. Any house of God, really. It kind of referred to pagan temples and buildings, and it got slapped onto the Jesus movement during the era of the Holy Roman Empire, as like the Christian church kind of mashed up with these pagan traditions that said you needed beautiful, ornate, giant temples to go to church in, and so the people of Jesus started meeting in those buildings, and they're like, oh, it's Kirche, it's church, right? But the word we translate church in the New Testament has absolutely nothing to do with the building. It's the word ekklesia. It means called out ones. It's about a group of people chasing Jesus together. It's a word that describes community, a community built for each other. Church is a people, not a place. It's a body that works together and loves each other and needs one another. We need other people because we are incomplete without them. That's the first major implication of what Paul tells us in Romans 12. And the second one is this: other people need us because they are incomplete without us. And that one sometimes is trickier because we occasionally can be honest with ourselves in the mirror and be like, yeah, you know what? I cannot do this alone. I need other people. But still believe that we have nothing to offer them. Like, I want to get something from other people, but who am I? How could I serve? How could I help? I got nothing. And what Paul's telling us here is that could not possibly be further from the truth. Everybody around us needs us, and he drives that home in the verses right after the body metaphor. In verse 6, he writes, we all have different gifts according to the grace given to each of us. If your gift is prophesying, then prophesy in accordance with your faith. If it is serving, then serve. If it's teaching, then teach. If it is to encourage, then give encouragement. If it's giving, then give generously. If it is to lead, do it diligently. If it is to show mercy, do it cheerfully. And Paul's saying, look, God has equipped you with some certain gifts that are meant to bless everybody else. If you go it alone, you don't find a way to plug in, you're robbing them of you. You're robbing them of the beauty that you can add to their story. Everybody loses when you aren't connected. You lose, they lose, we all lose. Because God made us for each other, and he expects us. Like, if we're going to follow him, if we're going to chase the dreams he's placed inside our souls, if we're going to live the stories he wants to write for all of us, he expects us to get connected to a people we can serve. And Paul lays that out pretty powerfully. He says we're all members of one body. And in verse 5, he says we all belong to each other. We belong to, that's intense. The idea that we belong to one another. But what Paul's trying to get us to understand is like, we're God's plan for each other. We're God's gift to each other. And part of being, everything that he made us to be, part of living fully human and fully alive means leveraging ourselves for the sake of the people around us. Like, the truth is, you will never be who you were made to be alone. It's a picture of a redwood forest, and redwoods are incredible. Each tree can live thousands of years. They can grow to be over 350 feet tall and weigh in the millions of pounds. The largest one in the United States is named the General Sherman, and it's estimated to weigh 2.7 million pounds. It's the largest single living organism on the planet. And you look at these pictures and you hear those numbers and you'd imagine that redwoods have like really deep root system. But they don't. Their roots are incredibly shallow, shallower than most trees. They're just interconnected. And so they can withstand storms and hurricanes and earthquakes in California. Because when the winds blow and the storms come and the earth shakes, their interconnected root system clings together. They need one another to survive. So do we. So who are my people? Who are your people? That question is a game changer for the next decade for your life if you stop to ask it and answer it regularly. Who are the people that are giving you life? Who are the people pulling you, encouraging you, drawing you toward Jesus? Like, if life means you got to be in the boat with somebody, who are the people you want to get in the boat with? I ask myself that question on a regular basis, and then I make sure that my time, my schedule, and my calendar reflects the answer. That I've cleared space to make sure I'm connecting with the people I want to be in the boat with, the people who breathe life into me and need life from me. And my challenge to you this week is really simple. Ask yourself that question, figure out who your people are, and then sit down and make sure they're a priority when it comes to your time. Like your family, your friends, your house group, your church, make sure you're making space to connect with those people, because connecting with those people is going to make the difference for you. Between a life that settles for less and the life that you're dreaming of. And I can tell you this, as a church, we would love to be your people. We want to build you up. We want to show you love. We want to encourage you. We want to pull you along toward Jesus. We want to row together with you. We want to serve you. And we also want to find a space where you can use your gifts to serve everybody else. We want to get you plugged in. And if you're not doing that right now, if you're not serving anywhere, there are a whole bunch of boxes on the back of your connection card that you can check, and we'll give you more information about how you can use the gifts God's given you to be a blessing to the people around you, to live that part of the story he has for you. But I'm going to be honest with you, because loved people do life with people genuinely is one of our key values here, you need a narrower answer to the question, who are my people, than just Revision Church. Because we're doing life and faith together, but you are not going to connect relationally and intimately walk alongside hundreds of people. Like, Revision Church is a layer in the answer to that question, who are my people, but it can't be the only layer. And your spouse and your family, that's a layer, and you need to connect well with them if you're going to live the life God has for you. But you also need friends. You need people who know you and people you know, people who are encouraging you, people who are rowing alongside you in the boat, people who are showing up for you, praying with you, and praying for you. That's why we do house groups. House groups are an opportunity to know and be known, to connect with a smaller group of people, life on life. People who keep showing up for you, and people who will challenge you to grow, and people who will poke you and prod you and ask questions about life and faith. People who will hop in the boat with you and row to the place that you want to go. I know that might sound really intimidating, and it might sound scary and vulnerable to like show up with a group of people who are going to ask you questions about your life, people who are supposed to know you and be known by you, and it is 100%. It's intimidating and vulnerable. I'm not going to lie to you about that. It's absolutely a scary thing to do, and it takes time. It's not easy to show up at the very beginning and try and be known by people and be honest with them about who you are and be honest with them about your life. It takes a while sometimes to get to that point where there's enough trust to be vulnerable and share prayer requests and do life and faith alongside people. But if you keep showing up for them and they keep showing up for you, it's so good, because one day you're going to look up and realize you're in the boat with some people who are rowing to the destination God has for you. And for me, yes, I would not trade those people for anything in the world, for anything. My family, my house group, my staff, this church, this is my people. That's my people, and my calendar reflects it. So I want to invite you this week to ask that question, who are my people, and to answer it, and to make sure your calendar reflects it, because you're living in a world that will constantly tempt you to go it alone, constantly tell you that you can handle it, you don't need anybody else, and you can do life on your own, you can do faith on your own, you can be self-sufficient, that you got it. But I got it. Results in too many broken noses and crooked tables for us to keep believing it will work. God built us for each other, and our journey towards him always leads us to his people, because his story for us is one of connection, love, and community. Will you guys pray with me? God, thank you for community. Thank you for people. Thank you for these people. Thank you for the way that this church and these people and my family and my house group and my friends have just been everything I asked you for so many years ago and more. And I pray for all of us as we head into a new decade, as we look ahead to 2010, that you'd help us ask and answer that question. Who are my people? Who are the people I want to be in this boat with? Who's rowing alongside me to the place that you have for me, to the dreams that you have for me? Who are the people that can connect the dots between the vision of my life that you've placed inside my soul and the journey it's going to take me to get there? God, would you just connect us to each other? We just praise you for the gift of one another. Praise you for the fact that in this messed up, broken, dark world, we don't have to walk our path alone. Would you just help us? Help us plug in to one another, to be known and to be blessed by each other and to bless each other. And we just thank you for the gift of your love and the gift of your people. In Jesus' name, amen.